You're listening to WCOM 103.5 LPFM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, North Carolina.
This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call. I'm Dick Paddock, co-host, and Emily and Lori are not available this week, so we're playing a recent address by Rania Masri, a local activist, and the Palestinian who lives in the Triangle, to members of Balance and Accuracy in Journalism on August 19th. We feel like it's a very important thing that needs to be spread throughout our neighborhood as much as we can. Her talk is entitled, From Ferguson to Palestine.
Home and to see so many friends and familiar faces.
We're here. This is the WILP Wake Up Call. We're here every Wednesday from 5 to 6 o'clock. And Dick Paddock was doing the lead-in, but he's not quite here. This was pre-recorded. He's off in Georgia to do good things there with the Southern Anti-Racist Network. But I'm here, Lori Hoyt, and Iris is here to take Dick's place at the board. And Iris, I consider you also co-host. You can pitch in and help me out anytime. And Emily O'Hare is doing the video camera. We have recently expanded our media network here. We're on the People's Channel. Our radio show is on the People's Channel. It's on Thursday nights at 10 o'clock in Chapel Hill, that's Channel 8, and I'm not sure what it is in Durham and Carrboro, but that's a kind of an exciting new thing for us. It's on, I think, at some other times on the People's Channel, but this is the time that I know definitely is on Thursday nights at 10 o'clock. So start watching. Okay, we're here. And we have a guest today, a guest that I'm very proud to introduce to you all. And probably doesn't need any introduction to the community. She's made herself very well known here, and it's Ronnie Dossey. And she just has been elected to the Chapel Hill Carrboro School Board. And I think I'm right, she was the highest vote getter. There were several candidates, and Ronnie just shone. And I'm so glad you're able to come today.
Yeah, so thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I first met Ronnie several months ago. She started coming to the NAACP Education Committee, and I really appreciated her making that commitment and effort to really understand how people in the community are viewing the schools and what they are seeing are problems and issues. And I think you also, how long have you been in this community, Ronnie?
So I've lived in Chapel Hill about 8 years now.
Oh, that long. Uh-huh.
So, actually, I live in Carrboro.
Yeah. Oh, Carrboro, my favorite, even though I'm just over the line now in Chapel Hill. And you have children in the school.
I do. I have four children. So
I thought I remembered four.
Yes. My oldest daughter just started high school this fall, and that was an interesting experience, but it's going great.
And what high school is she doing?
She is at Chapel Hill High.
At Chapel Hill, mm-hmm.
And I have a seventh grader at Smith Middle School, a third grader at Frank Porter Graham Elementary School, and the Spanish dual language there, and a newly minted five-year-old. And I keep saying four, and he reminds me that he is now five.
He is now five. So he is in preschool?
He is in preschool at United Church Preschool, which is a really fantastic place.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you have, more than going to any organization, you have an intimate, personal view of what's happening in school with a wide range of schools,
yes,
from high school down to preschool.
Absolutely, and that's part of what got me interested in running as I got more involved in the schools, understanding how it worked and didn't work in some cases for some students,
mm-hmm.
and having some ideas about how we could make changes to help improve outcomes that was really learning in a lot of different ways. And so having, you know, every level of pre-K through 12 covered mm-hmm. really gives me a lot of motivation to continue to work to improve the school systems.
So seeing things for your own, situations for your own children is what really spurred you, because it's a huge commitment to both to run for something and then all the meetings and, you know.
Absolutely, yes. But, you know, so I
it's not a lot of, it's not a lot of fun.
Right. Well, so it can be fun.
It can be, but.
And I definitely got excited because of what I learned from my children's experience, but also seeing the experience of other parents and community members with regard to education and just mm-hmm. having some ideas about how we can work together as a community to have better outcomes for all of our students. And that's
yeah.
something that wakes me up every day, and I think about it as I'm falling asleep. And, you know, I'm really excited to be in this place where people care so much. The fact that we have 8 candidates running for the board, you know, an unpaid, essentially unpaid position is really says a lot about our community.
And about their commitment to education. So where did you come here from? Where are you originally from?
So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, actually a little town called Lorain, Ohio, just west of Cleveland.
Lorain, that's my name. Lori's the nickname. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yes. And I'm the oldest of 10 children.
Of 10?
So, yes, we had a very busy house, but very exciting. And I went to school in Chicago and did my undergrad in Evanston, just north of the city of Chicago, at Northwestern University, and graduate school at the University of Chicago. And then we moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and were there for about 8 or 9 years, and then we came to Chapel Hill.
What brought you to Chapel Hill?
So my husband was looking at graduate school, and we were considering going back to Chicago, and we had 3 children at the time, and we said, weather, cost of living, traffic, let's go to North Carolina. And we have had such a wonderful experience here.
Did you have any family or friends here?
I had one of my best friends who we went to graduate school together had moved, and her and her family live in Wake Forest, but no family and really not a lot more than that.
So that's kind of brave to be far from family.
That is definitely the biggest issue is we do miss our family.
You come from a large family. Mm-hmm. Are most of them still back in Ohio and Chicago?
They're pretty much all over.
I have
a sister in Chicago. There are a couple siblings in Ohio, one brother in Indiana and Texas. And now there's one here in Hillsboro, which is very exciting. And I keep trying to beg, bribe my parents to come down, but so far they're stubbornly clinging to Cleveland, and I just think I have one good winter to get them down here. So unfortunately, the last time it was really cold there was also a little bit colder here than normal, and so that didn't really work for
me. You're still hoping, though?
I'm still hoping.
Now, I think I remember that that you're an engineer.
I had studied engineering in undergrad and did a lot of work around helping introduce engineering to high school students, and mm-hmm. particularly women and girls. I have a real passion about students not feeling limited, or people not feeling limited in opportunities. And I think sometimes because women and girls don't see themselves represented in certain career options, mm-hmm. that they tend to self-select away from them. And so my work was really around working with the National Society of Black Engineers and the Society of Women Engineers to really be a voice for women in engineering and introduce them to those careers.
How did you get into engineering? Was your father an engineer, or your mother was engineering? That was such a sexist question.
No, I was laughing with a friend earlier, sort of. You know, when you start at 17 or 18 college, you barely know the world, and you don't even know what you don't know, so sometimes it's hard to decide. I actually went to college thinking that I would study medicine, and so I was really interested in how I help people, and my mom would say, well, you could help through medicine or education, and I got there and started as a chemical engineer with the eventual goal toward becoming a physician. And I did a year in chemical engineering and did an internship over the summer, and really discovered I wasn't very interested in kind of traditional research lab work. I was very much more social and interested in people and processes. And I changed my study to industrial engineering, which is really about how people and processes work most efficiently.
Ooh.
And allowed very much more of the people interaction, which was where I was more comfortable. And
I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's what I ended up graduating with, industrial engineering and management science, and a minor in Spanish.
Uh-huh.
And so I did work in engineering and process management and control. I was a plant manager at a box plant in South Chicago.
Uh-huh.
For a couple of years. And then my general manager left, and he offered me a job as a capital manager, where I had responsibility for managing the capital assets of this company called Stone Container, which is also a paper company. And that was a fascinating opportunity in that I learned a lot of negotiation skills and mm-hmm. really working with a lot of the manufacturing facilities. When we looked at consolidating them, what types of things should we consider and how to think about the people element and all of those engagements. And it was just a really great learning opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fortunate to have strong support and mentors along the way, which I think I would advise everybody to try to seek that out if and anything they do in life, because you can always learn from people who've had a lot of experience.
So you got support. You didn't get dissed by the other guys being...
No, you know, I was incredibly lucky, and I, you know, certainly as a woman in engineering, I was typically the only one in the room, and usually
that.
The youngest, and not so much that anymore, but very fortunate to have some really great male mentors who sort of ahead of their time understood what that might feel like to be the only person in the room, and you know, to have a man say the same thing you've just said, and then, wow, that's a great idea, Jim. And, you know, I just said that, you know.
No, that was lucky.
Or to be talked over. And so my family laughs at me now because I'm pretty insistent on not being talked over. And part of it is because of that early experience of, you know, I'm talking, and I'm usually soft-spoken, and so it can be easy to sort of, you know, get missed in the conversation when there are a lot of folks around the table. But that's something I learned from that experience.
Well, and I wonder if holding your own with siblings and with 10 children, if that wasn't maybe a really important experience.
I think that certainly helped.
What birth order are you?
I'm the first.
Yeah, you're the oldest. Yeah, mm-hmm. A lot of power there.
That's what they say. But I'm fortunate. My siblings are all really amazing people, and it's interesting. I don't think when you're a young child that you appreciate your siblings as much as you grow to do as you mature. And I remember at some time saying to my mom, "Why did you have so many children?" And now I can't imagine my life without any of them. So
yeah, it's a good experience. You wanted to be the main one when you were little, but then now you see that there was some real advantages to having a lot of siblings.
Or not even the main one, just to do maybe less work, you know, because as the first one, you're kind of the second parent as well.
And yes, so you are. Yes, you are.
That could be challenging.
So you got interested in education with having children and also in trying to help encourage women mm-hmm. and girls to become an engineer. That's an education piece right there.
Right. Well, I've always been interested in education. So my mom is a teacher. She homeschooled us.
Okay.
I went to school, public school, when I was in sixth grade. And
okay.
So part of that, and I talked about being the oldest, I got to be the teacher for some of my siblings.
Uh-huh.
And so really got to see the influence of education and how prioritizing education is so important in outcomes for children and people. And so, you know, that early engagement was really critical for me, but it carried over through life. So throughout college and after and all the rest of my life, I've been involved in tutoring and mentoring. And I just, again, feel so strongly that people need to see themselves reflected in the leaders, and they need to see people who make them feel like they can do things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important in education. And I think that, for me, that's how I serve my community, is through education.
Mm-hmm. So coming here, you've been here for 8 years and have seen how our schools operate. Mm-hmm. And what have you seen as some of the issues that you want to work on?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say is, again, I'm just so proud of the community where people care so mm-hmm. much and they're so focused and they're mm-hmm. willing to provide resources. You know, looking at how the county commissioners have continued to fund the schools, how the community has responded to requests for bonds and tax increases, and hopefully we'll continue that trend as we go out next year with the bond request for the schools, significant capital needs. But I would say, you know, the big issues I think about are really around communication. I feel like we have some great initiatives in the school district, but we struggle a bit with how we engage people and bring them along. And part of the success of implementing a strategy or an idea is, you know, sort of bringing the people along with you. And so I think where we've had challenges is we've wanted to make it perfect before we presented it, but by the time it's perfect, people feel disengaged, and so they start to question all of the background of the work that was done. And what I'd like to see us do is really bring the community on the journey with us, and maybe we don't end up with a perfect product, you know, as fast as we would like, but it gets implemented more perfectly because we have that engagement early on. And in a lot of cases, you end up with better outcomes when you engage people earlier.
So are you thinking, you know, that things that they're trying to do are sort of top down and not engaging teachers to participate as much, or parents and the community?
I won't say every effort, but a significant effort has been made to engage. But I think that, again, we've focused on really getting it perfect before we go out. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, hey, this is not perfect, but here's where we are, and how do we bring community, teacher, administrator, mm-hmm. You know, et cetera, into the conversation earlier, so that by the end of it, we've sort of worked out all the kinks and we're able to have a product or mm-hmm. an idea that we're able to more easily implement.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is, I think, community engagement. So I love when I see elected officials out at places where I am and listening to people. I think part of the challenge is, you know, our community has changed pretty significantly. And so traditionally we've sort of been able to sit in the meetings and say, come to us and tell us your issues. And now I think there's a role that the board can play to go out more strongly into the community and seek those ideas and opinions much more actively.
Yeah.
And I think that will help as well.
Yeah.
So I would say communication is one issue. Certainly we talk really a lot about the achievement gap.
That's absolutely
a persistent, significant issue that we all should be very engaged and aware of. And one of the things that I know and have learned is there are a lot of resources, and it's really how do we put them together. It's a system problem, and I've heard a lot of criticism of teachers and kind of components of the problem. It's a system problem. You know, mm-hmm. I think that teachers are doing great work out there. That, you know, we can do more in a lot of places, and I think we will do more with professional development, but it's not just the teachers.
Absolutely
responsibility
not.
To fix this persistent problem. And so one of the things that I really want to focus on is, one, making sure the teachers feel engaged and valued, and really advocating with the county and the state for increasing teacher compensation, and then making sure as we have these discussions that all of the stakeholders are involved, again, very early in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of it is, what do we do as a community? There's a lot of community groups. You know, I've said during the campaign, we could have the perfect school but have kids who come to school who are not fed or don't know where they're going to sleep at night. So mm-hmm. the other part of the work that has to be done, and it's not necessarily the school's responsibility, but we can certainly partner because we have an invested interest in the outcome, to work with community groups to make sure that our parents and teachers have places to live that they can afford, and that, you know, our kids' parents have homes and housing, that they have access to health care and nutrition. And so how do we put all of those pieces together in a way that helps solve this achievement gap?
I think that's so important, and I think that you're right. If a child doesn't know where they're going to lay their head that night, mm-hmm. if the parents are so stressed kids pick up on that right away. Absolutely. And so one of the ways we can help kids in school is to make sure that there is adequate housing, that the mm-hmm. parents get some support to instead of blame. Just like there was a letter to the editor or an op-ed piece by a teacher recently in the mm-hmm. Chapel paper. You may have read it.
Yes.
Very frustrated, feeling that the teachers were being blamed for mm-hmm. all of society's ills, you know. And,
yeah.
and they're already being so dumped on by the state and with what they're making. And I just think it's so important that we do whatever we can to help the teachers feel supported, but also the parents very easily feel like they're being blamed. And they are being blamed sometimes. Mm-hmm. Oh, they don't come to a teacher meeting. Well, maybe they're working two jobs,
right.
or maybe the car broke down. And so I think it's so important that I love what you're saying, that we engage and try to support all of the stakeholders,
right.
you know,
the
parents, the teachers, and have them feel that they are respected and that their input is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not easy to go out and reach out. Like that.
Definitely. And I actually know the teacher who wrote the letter, and I know that he is a very caring individual.
I'm sure he is.
You know, puts his heart into his work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt frustrated watching some of the criticism that felt directed at the teachers. And I know that
I did
some
too.
Of this came from the response from the district to the press conference that was held by the community equity group about their frustration, about our frustration, about the achievement gap. And I think that, you know, the wording that was used in that response was unintended, and I don't think that the intent was to criticize the teachers as much as it felt like
mm-hmm.
in the reading of that. And
words are so
again,
important.
I agree.
Words are
agree.
So important.
To go back
important.
To the communication issue we continue
yes.
to struggle with, that's part of it.
Yes.
But certainly, you know, that teacher is a pretty amazing person
yeah.
who does a lot of work and really cares about students and cares about this issue.
Yes. So. Yeah, and that was apparent in just the way he did speak up, that you could tell he just cared so much and was so frustrated,
mm-hmm.
you know, with giving, you give your all and then you feel dumped on
right.
is not a good thing.
But again, I don't think the intent was to dump, you know.
I don't think it was
this
either.
Is where we,
it was out of frustration.
Right.
Yes, it was. But again, in these public meetings,
words are important.
How the issues are addressed and what kind of respect is being shown to whether it's parents or mm-hmm. teachers or the kids themselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a big job that you've taken on.
It is.
And
my husband laughs. He says, "Are you ready for this?" But then he says, "If anybody is, you are." So, but I'm most excited that I think we have a great team as well. I'm really excited. Again, I appreciated all the people who ran. I think, again, that's really important for our children to see that support. And we had
mm-hmm.
some strong candidates, and it ended up with the group we have. And I think it's a great group.
I think so. Besides
so,
you, I think the ones
yeah.
who were voted in are all excellent. And I think it's good to get some new people in and some new energy
mm-hmm.
because it's really hard dealing with issues for a long time. And I'm very hopeful that with this in new school board in the way it is new,
a few
incumbents still there, but I think that you're all bringing some really good energy and really good
mm-hmm.
knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and I think for the school board maybe to, I'm hoping it will be a little more responsive to the community and parents than the previous school board was able to be. And
well, that's definitely one of my goals. And one of the things I've talked about in the campaign is my commitment to continue to be out as if I was campaigning. And my husband says, "You can't do it that much." But certainly,
he's hoping to have a little bit of you for him.
But certainly, attending events and listening and being available, you know, this is such a, education is a thing that people care so much about. And we've got some really smart people, and I just want to hear their ideas on
mm-hmm.
how we fix these really big problems we have.
Yeah, I think what I've really appreciated about you is that you are a good listener.
Thank you.
And, you know, and I think that's just so important. And instead of saying, "Oh, I'm going to save it all, I've come in with these great ideas," I could, for months you've been coming and listening
mm-hmm.
and trying to understand and be a participant, but also a really good listener, and I think
Thank
that's
you.
Really important. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So your vision for what you're hoping your part will be in making things better in the schools is increasing, but making better communication.
Sure, yeah. So I think, you know, I talk about strengthening the core of our schools. And so part of that is increased educational outcomes for all students.
Mm-hmm.
We start with our initial focus on those children who have been underserved. Mm-hmm. And part of that is education, and part of that we talked about is the engagement with community groups, and part of that is really continuing to advocate for our teachers. I think it's a travesty that we, you know, pay teachers as little as we do and ask them for so much, and they are really the, you know, one of the most important groups in our children's lives. And
they really are.
That just continues to frustrate me, and I don't understand in North Carolina, the legislature, sort of what the end goal is. If we talk about education as a key economic driver, and we've done amazing things like establish RTP, you know, sort of our Silicon Valley of the East, but then you don't support the folks who would need to staff those companies that might come here for that mm-hmm. type of work. And that one just feels really frustrating. So I really would like to put a lot of energy into how we turn that around.
Mm-hmm.
And the frustration is that we have to be talking about this, and we should be talking about so much bigger things in education. You know, how do we teach broadly? And, you know, with the changing needs of our community, we have, you know, increasing free and reduced lunch children, and we have increasing people from different countries. And we really need to think about how we serve those community groups mm-hmm. as effectively as we've served the majority groups in the past. And
mm-hmm.
we're talking about fundamental things like paying teachers. That just, I don't understand that.
Yeah, it's like we shouldn't have to
right,
put our energy
you know,
going
I would
there.
Like, check that box. That's, of course we do that.
And, yeah.
But we're still talking about it.
The other issue, it's sad that we still have to talk about, is the issue of race. In addition to that very moving letter from that teacher with his frustration, there was another letter in the paper around the same time from Mary Carey,
mm-hmm.
and she has a black kid and a white kid,
mm-hmm.
and wrote this heartbreaking letter about how she and the child were treated differently mm-hmm. when she was out in the community shopping or doing whatever with her black son,
right.
or whether she when she was with her white son. So that was just like, right there, you know, moving testimony mm-hmm. that racism, even in a liberal community like mm-hmm. this, is still very alive and well, and
yeah.
unfortunately. And I thought, I mean, you couldn't devise a better experiment. The same mother
right.
in the same
right.
community,
right.
you know, with her one child of one color and another child when she was out separately
mm-hmm.
with them. And I was shocked myself, really, at the disparity with how she and the child were treated. That really did surprise me.
Yeah. Well, what I was so proud of her in that letter was, one, you know, she could certainly choose to not raise her voice in this, right? But she's a mama bear, and that's what we do, is we speak out for our children.
Yeah.
And, I think the power in what she's doing is raising awareness. And I actually wrote her a note back, and I just said, I literally had tears in my eyes when I read this. My family has had very similar experiences. We've done everything that society tells us we're supposed to do to be successful. And yet, you know, my brothers continue to be accosted by the police and have issues. And my brother is a veterinarian, and he was a speaker on a panel. And he arrived at the panel, and he was with a group of his white friends, and they let all of them in and then asked him for his ID. And he said, "That's my name up there. I'm the panel speaker." And they were like, "We need to see your ID." And so when you start to, you know, live those experiences, I think it's really powerful for people to know that happens. And people have said to me, "Well, that wouldn't happen to you. You're so well-spoken. You've gone to the right schools." And I said, little do you know.
It happens to
everybody, you know. So I think it is certainly important to raise awareness of those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
And I also want to say one thing. I think historic context is so important. I've also had people say to me, you know, racism, slavery was so long ago, you know, people should get over it, everything's changed and everything's fixed. And I would just offer that example, what I just shared about my brother's story. But also, you know, in my lifetime, my mother went to school and she was not allowed to live on campus because she was black.
Where was this at?
In Chicago.
In Chicago.
In my lifetime. And so that's just one example, but it's a pretty significant example. When you put that in the context of the parents who have lived negative experiences within the schools and are now sending their children, you can sort of understand why some of them are hesitant to engage or be involved mm-hmm. or even trust that the schools will deliver better outcomes for their children. I think we have to keep those kinds of that history in our minds as we approach engagement with parents and as we approach professional development training for teachers, because it's not something that might be intuitive to a white person who doesn't have this experience. And it's not that they're a bad person, and it's not that they're trying to be racist. It's you don't know what you don't know. And
I want to come back to this. I think we have to do a station break right now. We'll come back because this is such a big topic, and it's so visceral, right to the heart.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. Thank you.
This is Wilf's Wake Up Call on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carver, underwritten by the Internationalist Bookstore located at 101 Lloyd Street in Carver. You can stream us live at wcomfm.org.
Oh, I'm sorry. What? Are we on? Oh, okay. that was fast. Do we have any announcements? Is there any announcements we're supposed to read for the... Oh, you're giving it to me, are you? Let's see. Well, I don't... Okay, invited to the Clayworks Annual Holiday Pottery Sale, Saturday, December 5th at University Place, formerly University Mall. That might be nice to support. A lot of local ceramic artists will have their pottery available. I wish it was on here, that this weekend is Carbro's Film Festival. And check your local paper. I can't give you the details, but this is something that would be really great to support. I think they have it on Saturday and Sunday. There's a whole lot of independent short films. And so this is both fun and enjoyable, and it's supporting emerging young filmmakers. And I think it's $15 for one day. I'm not sure, maybe $25 for both days, but you can see hours of film. You can, and they have a whole schedule about that. We're going to get back with our guest. I'm Lori Hoyt, co-host. And our guest is Ronnie Dossi, brand new member of the Chapel Hill Carbro School Board. And she's been coming for months to the NAACP's Education Committee. And that's where I got to meet her and just was so impressed that she took the time and commitment to do this, getting to know how the NAACP is feeling about things, to get to know the community better. And I was just impressed with what a good listener you are. Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's so important. And we ended before we got to the station break, we started talking about a difficult subject for the community, for the schools, and that is the issue of race. Mm-hmm. And Ronnie was sharing some of her experiences, and I like where you said, you know, people say slavery was so long ago, it's in the past, get over it, and just have no understanding of how recent it all is. And we went from slavery theoretically ending, but not really, in 65, but then went right into the Jim Crow era, which... and even if you're a young person in our lifetime, and there's still repercussions, there's still racism, and you know, for some people, if they're pretty old, they can remember their parents or grandparents who came out of slavery. You know, those stories are in families and are very real, but we tend to be an ahistorical culture, and which is one of our good things. We want to keep moving forward and being positive, but the past is not really a past. It is still sure. with us.
And that's why I think that's so important. Your point is so well articulated, because the past has such an influence on where we are today, and it's a really... You know, I think the biggest issue was the denial of access to resources that has had such a cumulative effect on where we are today. And one of the things that I talk a lot about is that, you know, if your grandmother couldn't read, it's less likely that your parents could read and less likely that you read, right? And so if you'd go back, and I just share the story of my mother who couldn't live on campus, and something I'll add is, you know, her high school counselors advised her to become a secretary because they didn't think there were other careers for blacks that she would be successful at. And, you know, when you talk about teachers, the power that they have on a student's life is so profound. And if you literally have teachers not believing in you, and worse, saying mean things to you and not protecting you in your class space, that's a huge detriment to learning, and that carries over for generations and generations. And so I think we really have to be historic about why some of the problems we face today are here, and then really use that context to help solve. And again, I try to, you know, as an engineer, be very factual about things. And we sometimes get emotional about this thing because these are, like you said, very visceral, very raw things. And I think, but if we try to look at what our goals are, which are, you know, improved outcomes for our students, and take away our hurt feelings and emotions about things, you know, we really focus on the goal, and I think we get to a better place. But we have to understand where we came from to know how to fix where we are today.
Yeah, and I think, well, this is a good community, and, you know, it's a university community. The difficult thing is that there are so many kids who are so advantaged, you know, whether they come from their fathers or parents are mm-hmm. in the university professors, or they come from the, out of the medical mm-hmm. doctors or whatever. I remember, this is a white friend years ago, her daughter, they had divorced and the father was a doctor even, and in school, she felt run down because the other kid she felt was so smart. Even as for a white kid, it's like, unless you're like this super hero, you know, just burning the books. I don't know what they do. But so many kids, if they're more like average kids or whatever they are, it's always one up and one down. You know, it's so strongly competitive that there's going to be these winners, and the way we're looking at things, somebody's got to be a loser, right. Or that's how it's sort of set up, or feel like a loser.
Yeah.
And I just think it is so easy for some kids to get lost in this hyper-competitive system.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I talk about strengthening the core of the schools.
Yeah.
And I think if we have a strong foundation, everybody benefits, right? Like, I think it's great that we have advantaged people, but I think they also need to be aware that they have those advantages and not... sort of try to leverage those over people who don't have
exactly,
them.
Exactly.
But, you know, one of the things I think, you know, we talk about teachers and we talk about making sure we have curriculum that includes awareness of equity issues in the context of history and how we got to where we are and how people got to be disadvantaged and advantaged. That's really important to making us have a strong core in the schools. And I think when we get to that place, you're able to have a much more balanced field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better for everybody when everybody is uplifted. And that's where I think, you know, the community can really come together around, you know, beginning the focus to address the historically disserved, underserved people
mm-hmm.
who are not all black, by the way.
No, they're not.
And then, you know, really working then to build our whole community and strengthen all of it.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to allocation of resources, I think that's why I think it's so important to have a school board aware of these things, to have community aware, so that resources get more fairly allocated mm-hmm. and don't come to those who have the loudest voices or that sort of advantage over instead mm-hmm. of wanting to share more and realize mm-hmm. that how all the kids do is what's important for the community.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That they're well, yeah. all our kids.
That's what I say. We're all connected. And so
yeah.
because of that, everybody matters. And I think that's also why it's so important for school board members to be out in the community.
Yes.
So, you know, they're not just hearing the same voices who can take off their job or come to the school board meetings and, you know, bring their groups of people to complain or you know, offer, you know, when they're happy. But we need to be out there listening to everybody and
mm-hmm.
making sure we're balancing those voices and we're understanding where the true needs are and how we make sure we allocate toward that.
Well, there was, obviously, I read the papers.
You do read the paper.
There was a really interesting guest column by Judy Jones, mm-hmm. who was a teacher for 28 years mm-hmm. in our school system. And the headline is, Closing the Gap Will Require, just what you're talking about, Opening Hearts and Minds. Mm-hmm. And she talks about, she quotes Arnie Duncan, the U.S. Secretary of Education, about teachers. Teachers' leadership means having a voice in the politics and decisions that affect your students, your daily work, and the shape of your profession. And she says, in Chapel Hill, Carborough, we need to have structures and policies in place that support our mission to provide the best possible education for all of our students. And, you know, I think we're echoing what she and others are saying. I think if enough voices kind of get these ideas across, we may see some real progress. Is
yeah.
what we always have that hope.
I agree. And what I'm really excited about is this is a conversation, right? Like, I don't remember growing up ever hearing people say the words black and white in a, you know, positive context publicly, right? Like, we talk about it privately or negatively,
mm-hmm.
but that so many people are coming together and being aware that there are issues and
mm-hmm.
challenges that are race-based and
mm-hmm.
talking about solutions for that, I
mm-hmm.
think is so important and
mm-hmm.
really helps to get to, you know, some of the fundamental things behind the gap.
Well, because another issue that that the Education Committee for the NAACP worked on, I'm not sure if when you got there, that's something we were still working on, and that's the role of the SROs,
yes.
the security officers in the school. You know, we just had that recent horrifying video of cop in the school hurtling that child mm-hmm. across the room. And I think and hope that was certainly not standard, but I think that kind of brutality happens more than we would like to think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we've been trying to work with the school system. When we started talking to them, they really didn't have too much to say about what the role is and what kind of training they have. You know, then we found out that the schools pay a lot of their salary, but they weren't the ones who hired them or had or interviewed them. So we're trying to work to have the schools take more of a real proactive role
sure.
if they're going to be in the school. But, you know, there's now articles in Nationwide magazines about why are we having cops in the
mm-hmm.
school. And what I had not realized is that that's a relatively recent phenomena that we have so many
mm-hmm.
and that the Federal Justice Department really accelerated it in the 80s. With the cops in schools thing that they thought it was, and they were giving all the money to the schools to start doing that. And I think that it's not been proven to help reduce crime. And I think that's one of the things I'm interested in, and I hope that the school board listens to that, we start rolling some of that back.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm really excited about is the work that's been done along with the NAACP
mm-hmm.
and the school district on one of the challenges with having people who are used to seeing criminals in the school is you see criminals everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's certainly the ones I know are well-intentioned and good people and I think want the best, but there are also challenges when we're not trained in what is age-appropriate behavior for kids and the difference between the response of a child, maybe an adolescent who's already a little bit, you know, brain development, you know, for the
Absolutely.
Teenagers is takes a long time in coming. But so if you're not used to understanding those things, you might see their behavior as what you might see in a criminal. And so I think really one of the things that I really like about this, what's happened recently between the NAACP and the school board and the school district is the development of a memorandum of understanding
yes.
that outlines training requirements for the SROs in the schools. And part of that, I'm hopeful, includes understanding what's just age-appropriate behavior for kids.
And that took months to get it. I mean, we brought that up, and
yeah.
feet were dragging a little bit,
yeah.
and it was having to push, because I was just absolutely surprised at how the opposite of proactive the school was mm-hmm. about that, and
yeah.
and I'm hoping that we're making a start on that,
mm-hmm.
but when you're seeing that the budget is not as much as we need or would hope to have,
mm-hmm.
and you see what a big chunk of it goes there. That's I'm hoping that will continue to be
yeah.
looked at and questioned very seriously.
Yeah, I do think that they can play a role, though, because one of the things that I know is that some children come into any interaction with a police officer assuming the worst, because the only time they've ever seen a police officer, something bad has already happened. And so my hope in this is that seeing these folks in kind of more leadership partnership positions helps change that dynamic. And so children aren't afraid of seeing a police officer
mm-hmm.
and that they know that the police officer is there to serve and protect and not. And you're making a face, Lori, but I do believe
I'm rolling
that,
my eyes,
I know,
yes.
I know. I do believe that there are some benefits, and also from a safety perspective. And I know we could have a very long conversation about that, but within the guidelines of what the Memorandum of Understanding has begun and the conversation that we now have raised awareness on around the disparate discipline that has been imposed on children of color and how some of their behavior has been criminalized when it's the same behavior as white children, I think we have a broader platform to make a better outcome of those police
I think it can
school.
Be improved, but I'll tell you a recent thing that I didn't see personally, but in one of the schools, and I think it was a high school, some kids came in a little late from the bell.
Mm-hmm.
Some were white and a few were black.
Mm-hmm.
The black kids, when the SRO said something to them, said yo or yeah,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was for what they knew and for their culture, this was like an appropriate response.
Mm-hmm.
The white kids were able to go right back to the class. The other kids got written up.
Mm-hmm.
The black kids got written up. So I think a lot of times there's cultural misunderstandings,
mm-hmm.
but I just think there's a long way to go in terms of giving those SRO officers the kind of training, like you said earlier, in
sure.
adolescent psychology,
right.
in cultural understanding.
Yes,
it's a lot, and I
mm-hmm.
just hope I'm just putting my 2 cents worth in this when I'm going to be on the school board, that I'm hoping that gets looked at. And also, it was brought up at a school board meeting a few months ago when the whole issue of the budget came up, and it was like, do we really need them in the middle school, you know,
mm-hmm.
maybe the high school? But and some school board members were not opposed to that. I mean, at least it was discussed. So I just like to get those ideas out there, that there's nothing so engraving that it's doing so well that we can't take a fresh look at it. And
Yeah, I think we're happy to look at everything. One of my
yeah.
priorities is to really make sure we understand the budget at every level.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to put the most priority on funding whatever is instructional and class related.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be how I make priorities on allocating money.
Yeah, yeah. So you have a lot of issues that you'd like to see addressed.
Yes.
That you'll be working mm-hmm. on.
Yes.
And when do you take charge?
So we're sworn in December 3rd, and that's the first meeting. So very quickly, yes.
So, okay. So I didn't know when it was. So that's
December 3rd, yes.
Yeah. You excited?
I'm very excited. I am. I don't come into this believing that I know everything. Mm-hmm. I just have a lot of ideas, a lot of energy, and a lot of passion. And I really want to continue to learn and really make sure we're going in the right direction. And I think as a board, we have to be flexible. You know, our environment mm-hmm. continues to change and the needs change. And we have outside influences like the state legislature that are going in the wrong direction. And we just have to figure out how to make the best of mm-hmm. what we have. And mm-hmm. because this work is so important, this is our children, our future, we got to get this right.
Yeah. And in spite of the legislature, that's one blessing with this community that because it is wealthy enough, we give a supplement to the teacher's salary. It's still not good.
Right.
But,
I think that, you know, that also might be a challenge in the future. You know, we continue to pay for most of our development on the backs of our residents.
That's
so
right.
What
taxes.
Do we do about economic development? I think, mm-hmm. you know, community members have been very generous in funding education and other community needs, but, you know, we're going to run out of that
yeah.
at some point, and we've got to be really thoughtful. And so I think we'll also have to spend a lot of time in conversations with town council and Chapel Hill and the aldermen in Carrboro and the county commissioners about how do we look at mm-hmm. strengthening the economic development in our community so that we can fund more of this local support that we need.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of development going on. I don't know how much it is going to help
bring in the revenue, yeah.
the tax base or not. That's what I think the hope mm-hmm. is, but it'd be nice to get some facts and figures on that because mm-hmm. it's a heck of a lot everywhere you turn.
Yeah, you do see a lot of construction.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So I hope that helped because you're right, taxes are very high. Mm-hmm. And in Carrboro, too.
Absolutely. And it goes to affordable housing and, you know, do we want only rich people to live
here?
Yeah. And, right. Like, how does that all work together?
Yeah. So is there anything we haven't discussed that I forgot to ask or comment on that you want to?
Well, I did want to talk a little bit about the bond that we're going to be asking for next year. And so I know that there's been some conversation that the communication around it has been primarily around Lincoln Center, and people's takeaway has been that this is for administrative offices. And I'll have to say I followed the development of this probably for the last 2 years, and I know they've been working on it probably since 2011.
Mm-hmm.
A really broad look at the capital needs of the schools. And if we look at, you know, the schools in our district, they have not been maintained over time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have literally mold and water leakage and small, tight, dark hallways, and we're asking our teachers to teach, and we're asking our students to learn in these environments, some of them that were built 60 years ago.
There's mold in some?
There's literally mold in some of our schools.
That's
and some
horrible.
Schools have continued, every time it rains, the building floods. And so this is what I want to get out there, that we truly, and I invite people, walk through the schools, you know, talk to the principals, where are your capital needs, because these are significant. This is not a situation of the district trying to build new offices. Really what's happening is in the capital list, they have identified three top priorities, and one of those is Chapel Hill High School. And if anybody's been on that campus lately, you will know that they are truly in need. And so the first one would be renovating one of the buildings at Chapel Hill High. And then the second one is the Lincoln Center. But the Lincoln Center, the idea is really to consolidate the pre-K classes into the Lincoln Center. So they would rebuild the Lincoln Center to accommodate all of the pre-K classes that are currently in our elementary schools. And what that does is that then frees up space in the elementary schools where they can then stage renovation of the elementary schools, which are significantly in need. And so what's nice about the consolidation of the pre-K program as it enables, one, the teachers to be together and have stronger professional development. It enables to have support staff like occupational therapy, physical therapy, mental health services in one location where you can then, you know, maybe even have a separate office or support center for those folks that then help with the pre-K program. And then the second part of the Lincoln Center renovation would be a second story that would house the administrative offices. But the primary driver is not to build fancy offices. And, you know, my background mostly for the past 20 years has been in corporate finance and strategy. And I will tell you, I am very much a budget-focused person, and I am very focused on priority spending being associated with whatever's in the classroom and the teachers need. So I would not support a plan that would build administrative offices at the expense of school needs. But this really is more about staging to enable renovation at the elementary schools. And it also allows us to delay building our next elementary school if the capacity starts to build, because we'll have additional space from consolidating the preschool. So I wanted to kind of clarify that, because I know there's been a lot of conversation. I think the district is still coming together with how the communication might look like on that, and that's going to be something we're asking, again, the community come back and support education. But this is something that is really, really needed.
Well, and will there also be, like, repairs made to, like, with the school that has mold? I mean,
sure. So that's Chapel Hill High, and that's the first. And
that's
so
the only school.
I stopped at Lincoln Center as the second one. The third one would be Glenwood. So doing
that's a pretty
Glenwood,
old one,
which is, I think,
I did some
one of the oldest
there a couple summers
ago. And then there's a list behind that. So there's significant. You know, if we look at the total amount that we need to fund the capital needs, it's close to $200 million. And I wish we could go ahead and do that now, but we, you know, that's certainly probably even from a can we do it if we had all the money today, we probably couldn't. And so that's something that we'll have to stage over time.
So
I do invite people to talk to your principals, go through your schools,
yeah,
you know, really look at this is truly a need to have safe, functional space where our students can learn and our teachers can teach.
Yeah. So that bond issue is coming up this fall.
It will be on the ballot in 2016, and it is a joint bond for Chapel Hill Carville City Schools and Orange County Schools.
So it's coming up in 2016.
Yes.
And how much are they asking for in this?
So they're asking for $125 million for the schools, and I believe there's an additional $10 million to support affordable housing and some senior center services.
So this sounds like all of it sounds, and I'm glad to hear you let us know that you've looked at that, because since you do have financing experience, you know, it's really hard for the layperson to know, because one of the first things I'd be thinking of, oh, Lincoln, okay, they want to have fancy offices.
And this is where I go back to, like, we've got to bring people along. Don't come with the perfect story, you know.
Yeah.
So we're gonna work on that.
You know, although I know Lincoln is pretty old, but I did read that they want to have part of that be, you know, for consolidating pre-K.
Right.
So I thought, well, I guess that's okay.
Right.
We have 2 minutes left. So this is something, okay, folks, anybody who's listening, talk to other people. This bond issue sounds critical.
It is
critical. We don't necessarily need fancy, but if we're having mold in the school, we're talking about people's basic health and safety there, you know. That's, and I know that school, you know, some of my children went to Chapel Hill High, and they're pretty old now. So it's pretty old school in Glenwood, too.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess I go to the library at McDougal, and that's such a nice new school. I kind of get mesmerized and forgetting that some of these other schools.
Sure.
Yeah, maybe we should start putting libraries or other things in some of these other schools.
To get people into the
schools. So people get in and say, hey, let's come see what's going on here.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm just so delighted to have you come to our radio show. I'm delighted with what you're telling us, and this is a big education in many ways, and especially about the bond issue, because I was not enthusiastic. I was still like, but you got me sold.
Good, thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciated the time and the conversation.
Just know you're going to be such an asset to our school board and to our community and to our kids.
Thank you.
And I'm hoping now we can all feel that we got a listening ear. It's Rani Dasi, R-A-N-I-D-A-S-I. It's such a pretty name, Rani Dasi. It's very alliterative.
So, thank you very much, good luck to you.
Good luck to you. Our prayers and hopes are with you.
Thank you. I'll be listening.
Yeah, you've got a big job ahead of you, but boy.